once more unto the breach, dear friends.
Else fill up the wall with our English dead.
Yes. Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, to another exciting second hour of The Personal Wealth Coach, where Jeff McClure may be heard to say...
That's very interesting.
This is Jake McClure. Jeff McClure is here with me, and we are back for a second hour today. So let's jump into it, shall we?
Let's do it.
This is another question from John, with multiple pictures from the Wall Street Journal in it.
And a good question.
Yes. The question is about the digital currency of the United States dollar and the prospective changes being discussed by the Federal Reserve, not just discussed, but planned by the Federal Reserve. It starts with, I'm kind of give the background on this before we get into what the article in question is. It starts with the concept of when you move money from one bank to another, having it occur same day or even instantaneously. You know, most people would say, well, of course, isn't that what you would expect to happen? Well, it is. But if you've ever had a closing check from a house sale or a big check from an insurance settlement or a very large deposit of a bonus check, when you deposit money from a check or when you're transferring money from one bank to another, which from their perspective is a lot like a check, they sit on that money for a while. And they say, yeah, we've got a number that says that you're allowed to touch it or not. And in the old days, you could call the banker and say, hey, Joe, what you doing sitting on my money? And he'd say, oh, I'm sorry, didn't realize it was you. Like he didn't know it was you with your name on it and all of that. This was part of the game. And if you were a business person, you'd just call the bank and say, hey, you know I'm good for it. And they'd say, oh, for you, sir, we'll just do this thing. Or, no, sir, we can't do it. It's the bank policy. And so if you've been in business or you've been around much, you know it takes a while for banks to move money. Why? Well, because when they move the money, they want to make sure it was at the place it came from before they say it's really there at their place. Or they can get burned really bad. And there's a scam that's been going on for years and years, and it'll give you a good example of this, where a person says, hey, I ordered your product and I really liked it, but and there's an email or a note and it says, but I only had this post office bond to pay with. It's the only thing I have and it's $500 and your price is only $283. If you just send me $20 is change in the product, you can keep the rest. I just need to get rid of this thing. It's the only money I have. So you get the bond and you say, oh, this is a great deal. Only most people that have gotten this already know this is a scam. Well, it didn't actually arrive because in some way it's fraudulent. Well, that's what the banks are trying to prevent here. So the Federal Reserve has been reading the Bitcoin white paper and saying, hey, if all the Federal Reserve banks are allowed to look in a transfer type setup at whether or not the money's already on the book for real at the other bank, this will speed things up. So that's the first component, instantaneous money transfers. That is huge for business. And I can't say that with any more emphasis. It is huge for business. It means that the flow of currency isn't stopped every day or every 3 weeks or every 6 weeks. When a big payment comes in for a contract, the money's available when it comes in. That's huge. In order for that to happen, we have to digitally mark each bank's currency. It's already digital. So when people say, hey, it's becoming a digital currency, oh, come on, it's already digital. At every bank, they have on their computer digitally what they have on the books. So you can't say it's a new digital currency. It's just got a digital signature. It's like the serial number on the dollar. It's like that. That says, hey, this moved from here to here to here to here. So they can track it easily from all sources along all range. Now, you can see there's some privacy issues there, but if it's only the banks looking at it, what could the banks do with a bunch of private... Oh, well, yeah, you see what I mean. So there are some privacy concerns, and the Federal Reserve is applying some privacy standards to it that are also similar to Bitcoin. And that the only way you can see who had that money private money previous to you down that long chain, even if you're the bank that's receiving the money, is if you get a warrant, you just know that it was there, not where it came from. Now, the Federal Reserve can get to that information with a warrant. So these are some privacy controls and stuff and so on. Okay, so now that we've got the background, the foundation of what this is about, the Wall Street Journal comes out with an article, and the article is interesting. The headline is "Digital Currencies Pave the Way for Deeply Negative Interest Rates." And so the question is, and if interest rates can go far below zero, monetary policy is suddenly much more powerful and better suited to tackle deflation. My answer to that, after that amazing long-winded and oratory performance, is to say we can already do negative interest rates if we wanted to. There's nothing preventing us from doing negative interest rates except us saying we don't want to do negative interest rates. I know, I just had this long-winded thing to talk about digital currencies and answer the digital currency question, but it isn't a digital currency question. And the guy who wrote this is correct that negative interest rates are great for tackling deflation. However, it doesn't require a digital currency. It doesn't even make it that much easier to do a negative interest rate if you have a digital currency. And that's, I could have just led with that and say, never mind, this is a wrong supposition. And go ahead.
The subtitle is important. If people can't hoard physical money, it becomes much easier to cut rates far below zero.
Yeah, yeah. That is a key there. It's a big one.
The problem with a negative interest rate is people tend to, when you get into deflation, people tend to sit on their money. They tend to say, I'm just going to hang on to my money. If you're in deflation and you have a coffee can, although we don't have coffee cans anymore.
Shoeboxes.
Okay,
you still have shoeboxes. Coffee cans more are like bags of foil.
You have an Amazon box full of money.
Okay.
Of paper money. And you have deflation. That paper money becomes more valuable every day.
Yep.
If we have inflation, a little bit of inflation, it becomes less valuable every day. In other words, right now, the long-term projection and the long-term target of the Federal Reserve is a little over 2%. So let's call it a 2.25% inflation rate. That means the Federal Reserve is engineering a 2% or 2.25% charge on hoarding money. If you have money sitting at zero interest rate wherever, whether it's in the bank or in a shoebox or in an Amazon box or dug in a tin can in your backyard, wherever you've got it, it's losing value at 2.5% a year. So people, when they're in that position, they have a tendency to spend their money because it's worth more now than it will be in the future. When we get into deflation, they have a tendency to hoard their money because their money is becoming more valuable with each passing day. That slows the economy down, causes more people to be laid off, which causes further deflation. If we have digital currencies, and that's all we have,
people can't
hoard their money.
Okay. So let me address that point as well. Physical money, the paper stuff, amounts to about, it's less than half of 1% of the currency in circulation. Even the people hoarding the money amount to less than half of 1% of the money out there. So this is the major issue here, is that the money is already digital. It's just not serial numbered. That is the point that I'm making, is that physical money, and during the Great Depression, you know, everybody's heard the stories about people sticking it in their mattresses, because they literally did. They put the money in their beds. They put it under their mattress. They put it in their floorboards. They were holding that money because it was becoming worth more every day. And because they were holding it rather than spending it, it was becoming worth more every day, because everybody was holding it and there was less of it around. You can still hoard money even if it's not physical in your bank account by simply not spending it. And that is the other side of this, is that what box you put the money in, whether it's a cardboard box, a coffee can, or a bank account, it's a virtual box, but it's still a box. Hoarding money still causes deflation. Spending too much money still causes inflation. The rules haven't changed because the number is stamped on the currency. And that's the thing, is that it's a complicated subject only if you make it complicated. It's already digital. The only thing missing from the digital currency to make it exactly equivalent to the paper currency is an individualized digital serial number to help track it from one bank to the next. That is the only transition that the Federal Reserve is talking about doing. But because the word digital currency is mostly used around cryptocurrencies, there's huge amounts of confusion around this concept. If you just keep it simple, all they're doing is they're going to the banks and they're saying, banks, let us look at your books and give a little ID number to every one of your digital dollars. Once we do that, we can track all the digital dollars, and now we have a digital currency, just like we do with the paper currency. That's all it is. It's just the Federal Reserve getting involved at each bank level to say this dollar is the exact same dollar that was over there. Right now, it's all mixed together. It doesn't matter. $1 is the same as another in this giant virtual pool of your bank account, or sometimes less giant, sometimes overdrafted. But it's still a virtual pool of negative money at that point. You can't track each negative dollar right now, at least from one bank to another. Each bank has an ID that they use internal, which is why they can do a bank internal bank transfer same day. That's how you can move money from your savings account to your checking account, and it's just there because they've identified each dollar. Okay, so that's it. That's the end of my long-winded, very short answer.
There's another aspect of digital currency that wasn't mentioned in the article I think is very important, and that is it pretty much does away with the underground economy. Digital currency means that there's a cat behind you.
Yes.
Digital currency does away with cash transactions, large-scale cash transactions. Matter of fact, to tell you what happens with large-scale cash transactions, I once had a Secret Service agent tell me,
Back when they were the ones in charge of counterfeit stuff. Yeah.
Yeah.
They were under the U.S. Treasury Service rather than Homeland Security at that point.
But he told me, and this was as a law enforcement officer, that if you took any $100 bill and you tested it for cocaine, you would almost be certain to find cocaine on it. He said he never tested a $100 bill that didn't have a trace of cocaine on it. Because massive... And if you've seen Breaking Bad or something like that, that's how the transactions occur.
That's not cocaine, though.
It's not.
No, that's methamphetamine. Meth. Yeah.
But the hidden underground economy, not to mention, of course, the underground economy that goes on where people pay in cash, large amounts of money in cash, and it's never recorded for income tax, is measured in trillions of dollars. And there was one report that came out that indicated that we would basically be able to come pretty close to balancing the budget in the United States, if we could just capture the taxes on the underground economy.
Yeah.
The money that's not being paid taxes on, which would be good for us fiscally. It would be bad for the people who, probably not particularly good for the people who want to shuffle cash around and not pay taxes. But I think it'd be good across the board. I think eventually we will go to a digital currency.
It won't be that long even.
Well, the problem with going to a digital currency is the banks no longer issue the money in effect. The money in trying to do it in such a way that it doesn't destroy the banking system.
Right.
And there's a lot of questions here. It's kind of like the difference. It's kind of like when we went from specie, which is only accepting silver and gold coins, to accepting banknotes.
Yeah.
And it's going to happen at some point. It's going to be a major shift, and it needs to be managed very, very carefully. The last time we tried this, which was in the 1830s, we triggered a depression, and then we went off the gold standard in 71 and triggered massive runaway inflation. It's not something that needs to be done by presidential executive order like it was in 1971 by Richard Nixon. It needs to be done carefully, thoughtfully, and coordinated, and there needs to be a lot of simulations run, but we're going there. We're mostly digital now. For example, if you do a credit card transaction, it's a digital strip on the back of your credit card.
The specie circular was also an executive order done by Andrew Jackson in
1836. It created the Depression of 1837.
Yeah.
So it's something we need to approach very carefully, and the Federal Reserve is experimenting with it. But I would say within 10 years, that's my guess, we will see us go to a digital currency.
That's right.
So the increased efficiency.
I mean, the Federal Reserve says they're going to do it this year. Now, it could be next year, but there's the actual transition to a digital currency isn't getting rid of the existing currency. And this is the big thing that people, from my perspective, the thing that's most confusing to people is that they think that somehow it's going to change what's already happening. Even what you just said, it sounds like you're thinking it's going to change the currency from one thing to another. And this is as simple as I can make it. This is really all that's going on. It's like a digital stamp or a digital identification number that goes with each piece of the currency down to the penny. So each penny is going to be digitally signed to say, this is me. I am unique. Right now, they're not unique, except at each bank. Each bank tracks each penny. I know, that's weird, huh? And they say, this penny was in that account over there a few minutes ago, and now it's in this account. And they know which penny it is because they've stamped it digitally. You kind of have to when you're doing internal balance transfers. The only change is that number is going to be ubiquitous across all banks. That penny's not going to change its name when it goes from USAA to Wells Fargo. It will still be George when it gets there, although it's going to have a more unique name than George. That is the only change that we're talking about.
Abraham.
Abraham might be it, too, or Ben.
Abraham.
Or
well, Abraham's on there.
Oh, yeah, Abraham is on, but he's a penny. So, but if you call them all Abraham, you're back to needing to have... You just call them Abraham 1 through however many pennies there are.
There it is. That's it.
And the only thing, and the piece of this that is weird, extra weird even, is that you're still going to have the metal penny that doesn't have its own name. So you may do a withdrawal from your bank for a penny. If you do that, you're a little weird. If you just want one penny, it's a little weird, but you could do it. You withdraw that penny from the bank, and that digital version of the penny just died. It is no longer in existence. It is destroyed because it's now represented by a physical penny. And wherever you go, when you deposit that physical penny, they're going to give you a new, absolutely never been made before, digitally named penny. That's all it is. And the Federal Reserve is going to be the one that tracks all the numbers for it, just like they do for the U.S. Treasury on the serial numbers on the existing dollars. You don't have serial numbers on pennies. You'll have them on digital pennies.
Maybe we'll do away with the penny.
Well, I don't know. I mean, at the bank level, it doesn't really matter. It's like fractional shares. It doesn't fill up your pocket in the bank.
If I could change the subject.
Yeah, please. I think we've killed this one.
Yeah, we have. I wanted to talk about the big picture. For those of you who
is it like a Monet? Is it a Manet? How big a picture are we talking about? How much paint
really,
was used?
A really big picture, more like an Adam Smith.
Whoa. He painted the invisible hand so well you can't even see it.
Well, it's because it's so big.
Yeah, that's probably it.
There was a few months ago, back in the spring and going into early summer, a general consensus among corporations that sometime around Labor Day, things would get back to normal. It's called RTO, return to office. They would basically say the supply chain was going to start cleaning itself up. People would be back in their offices and we could go back to normal business affairs as it was. And they made a lot of plans for that and anticipated a lot of the problems going away that they're facing right now and that they faced at the time. In case you didn't notice, on Labor Day, things did not get back to normal. Didn't even start to get back to normal. Matter of fact, they started getting more abnormal.
Well, I mean, this is a quote I'll give you every time this comes up. Being an adult means repeating to yourself for the rest of your life, things will get back to normal next week. Yeah, so go ahead. That should be in a corporate boardroom somewhere written on the wall.
I like that. Now they're saying, the general consensus seems to be that maybe by the end of the year, maybe we'll get back to the office. Maybe supply chains will start to clean up by the end of the year, but they're not even certain of that at this point. So what we're seeing and what's driving this train is COVID-19. specifically the Delta variant. To give you some idea what's going on, I do a chart of the cases per week, or the rise in cases in Bell County.
Let me just throw this in here, because economically we get this a lot. Why do you guys cover the pandemic so much as economists? Because the pandemic is the elephant in the tiny house. We can talk about taxes. We can talk about all the rest of it. And they are anywhere in size, from cockroaches to mice. There's an elephant in the room. Okay, continue.
Back at the end of May and beginning of June, we went 3 weeks in Bell County with no deaths from COVID. We had, for instance, on June 18th, the end of the week that preceded, and these are according to the state, we had 54 new cases of COVID in Bell County and 4 deaths.
So Bell County's in Texas. It's the county that the studio that we have done this operation out of for 20 plus years is.
And on 6/25, the week that preceded, we had 65 new cases, but only one death. Well, we're up to 34 deaths a week now and 150 new cases.
Yeah.
And 34 deaths per week in Bell County is the second highest we've ever had. And the hospitals are as full as they've ever been. And that tiny little picture tells you something. There's a restaurant that we were in the habit of eating at every week. Every Wednesday night, we went out with some friends to a restaurant near our house. We looked at the fact that it's been now 8 months since we received our COVID vaccinations, and my wife and I are both elderly, and we both have health issues. So we decided maybe we wouldn't go out to eat Wednesday night at that restaurant with our friends. And sure enough, we couldn't have gone out to eat anyway because the restaurant's closed. Why is the restaurant closed? Because they had several employees test positive or have both asymptomatic and symptomatic COVID. The church we go to is going to be not having a real service again on Sunday. Why? Because we have a confirmed COVID infection going on in the congregation. It's back. And it's having an effect on the economy. That's the big thing. It's having as much as an effect it's having in the United States, and it is having an effect in the United States, it's having a bigger effect overseas. Whole ports have been shut down in China because of COVID infections. Malaysia, many of their factories got shut down because of COVID infections. Their hospitals are full like they are here. People who have, for instance, a heart attack in the United States right now, it's going to be very difficult for somebody to get into the hospital, and perhaps impossible to get into ICU with a heart attack. That's the secondary effects of these COVID infections that are surging in the United States. In the rest of the world, it's having a similar or larger effect. As what does that mean to you economically? That means that prices, the producer price index, went up almost, well, some aspects of it for goods went up 1% this last month, which is a lot. That's 12% a year. And by the way, it's up 12% from previous year. Why did it go up? Because there's things you want to buy in the United States, and they can't find a single, there's one part missing. I was talking to a manufacturer representative this week, and I said, how is the pandemic affecting your business? He said, well, we've got, and it was a manufacturer of motorhomes. And he said, we can build the motorhomes, but we got one part we can't get. One part, the awning. So we got a bunch of motorhomes. We're building motorhomes. We're putting them on the lot without the awning. And we're running further and further behind on the production of the motorhomes. Well, what does that do?
Well, I could get a job. I can yawn. I can go out there and do yawning.
Awning.
Oh, I can't do awning. I can do yawning.
You'd have to spread out really wide and keep the sun off. And that's happening across the board. And what does that do? Well, we've talked about the fact that I think the price of used vehicles is up 25% over where it was last year. It was 45% a little earlier. Why? Because of the shortage of new vehicles, and people want a new vehicle. They want a different vehicle. Their old one's worn out or whatever. They're buying used ones instead of new ones. And that's causing inflation. It's causing inflation across the board. You may have noticed, we noticed that the price of food is going up. The price of just lumber is up. The price of just about everything is up. And it's up for a very simple reason. There's a COVID pandemic going on. And until that COVID pandemic gets put to bed and goes away, until it stops filling up the hospitals and filling up the ICUs, we're going to continue to see prices rise. And this is important from our perspective. We're going to continue to see the economy stumble. Now, here's one of the bottom lines to this that I think is important. Remember, I said that the producer price index has risen a lot over the last year. Producer price index for goods has risen over 12%. There's something called the PCE, the, I always forget what this is, Personal Consumption Expenditure Index,
right,
which is the one that the Federal Reserve uses, and it's probably the most accurate measure of inflation. It's up 3.6% over the last year, which is not too bad. Wait a minute. Producer Price Index measures wholesale prices. How much does it cost for the retailer who's going to sell it to you? How much are they paying for the stuff they're selling? And it's up 12% in the last year, but the price they're charging to the public is only up 3.6%. What does that mean? That means that the company that's selling the stuff, which is an economic term,
is lowering their profit margin.
It's squeezing the profit margin. And that is generating some concern out there among people who are watch this type of thing, including us.
Per item profit margin, I should say. And if they're selling enough new things by eating that cost, they could be increasing their profit margin by lowering their per item profit margin. We're seeing a lot of earnings are going up. So it's not like we're seeing the profit margin being squeezed. They're selling enough new things to make up for not increasing their prices as fast as their costs are increasing. But there's a limit to that.
Here's the concern. Last time retail spending was reported, which was for August, it dropped 1.1%.
Yeah.
Which means people are buying less stuff.
Now, they're still buying more things than they were pre-pandemic.
Yes.
And it's dropping down. That's why they're buying less stuff, because we're going back to more normal.
But the point is, if they're buying a little less stuff and the profit margin on the stuff they're buying is being
squeezed,
restricted,
yeah,
then the concern is that third quarter earnings by corporations that are publicly traded will come in lower than expected.
So what you're saying is that if people buy fewer things and the profit on each thing is less, profits will go down?
Corporate profits may. No.
Wow. It's true.
I don't think they go down. They just grow at a slower rate.
Yeah.
Right now, the market is priced for a certain rate of growth in the economy, a certain rate of growth in corporations. And that prices the growth side of the market, the large cap growth, which drives the S&P 500. And the concern, and I think it's a legitimate concern and one that we need to be prepared for, is we may soon begin to see third quarter estimates come in at a lower rate of growth. It's not like we're sliding into recession. China is at risk of sliding into recession, and it's being generated by the COVID-19 pandemic. India is in trouble. Vietnam's in trouble. They may be able to bail themselves out. They may not. They're on the edge. The United States is still growing, but I suspect the third quarter growth rate will be lower than was expected, and the third quarter earnings growth rates maybe need to be adjusted down. Now, this is not a bad thing. It doesn't mean we're going into recession. It doesn't mean that things are sliding backwards. But it's important to remember that the stock market is largely driven by earnings. And if earnings come in at a lower growth rate than was expected, some of the speculators might suddenly decide they need to go someplace else. And if that happens at the same time that the Federal Reserve begins to pull back on their stimulus, interest rates could rise at the same time. So what you could get is bonds going up, stock market going down. In other words, we are seeing, and by the way, this is the ideal time of year for it.
Yeah. We're getting right into October. Yeah. So
we're seeing a setup that could generate a correction.
Now,
and it's something that we need to be prepared for.
And having said that, this is a piece of education that when people hear us say something like that, they go, oh, I need to get out of the market.
No.
Absolutely not what we're saying. It is always a good idea to know why you're in a thing before you get out of the thing. It's probably, and I would say probably with like 100% degree of certainty, it's better to know why you're in the thing before you get into the thing. If you're uncomfortable being in the thing, it shouldn't have anything to do with what's going on in the market right now. It should be, hey, you're not comfortable with the concept of it going down, then don't be in it if it's something that looks really risky. So getting out of the market to prevent being in it during a correction is one of the worst mistakes smart market movers do. And it's repeated so often, I don't even know how to underline this more. when people hear, hey, we might have a correction, and then they jump out of the market, well, when do you get back in? What you do to prepare for a market correction is look at it and say, I can expect this thing to be, a correction's down 10%. I could expect this thing to be down 10% or more, and I just need to sit through that. So long as you're well diversified and you believe that the American economy is going to recover into the future, it's not going to fade slowly into some haunted memory of itself. We're not seeing signs of that. The innovation that we're seeing, the new product development, the technological advancements that are all centraled here say everything the opposite of that. So getting out of the market to it's kind of like not deciding not to go on vacation because it might rain on the first Monday. You don't make decisions like that if you're talking about a 3-week vacation. You say, oh, that first Monday, we'll figure something else out. You say, I'll be prepared for that. I'll bring an umbrella. That's what we talk about in the market, is that if you believe that the U.S. economy is doing well and the economy of the world is likely to grow, then being invested, well-diversified, even when we have the market go down, especially when we have the market go down, is the reason why you've gotten this great historical return. Because it's like faith in our system, whoever is in charge of it. And I think there have been enough changes in who's in charge over the last 10 to 15 years to realize who's in charge has a lot less control than we thought they did, or maybe more control than we thought they did. It's like the things we're afraid of them having control over, they don't have a lot of control over because we're afraid of it. But the things that we haven't considered yet, they have too much control over. It's just the way our system works. All that being said is we're not recommending diving out of the market here. We are always recommending that you look at why you are where you are and determine what you would do if that was in a much lower situation. Would it make you sell? Well, then you should probably be out of it now when it's not lower, when you could make a profit getting out of it. I know. Common sense is weird.
It's very important to recognize that market timing, determining that the market's going to go down, so bailing out, and then getting back in when you think it's the bottom, historically has proven to be the worst form of investing.
Yeah.
As a matter of fact, during long periods of time, people who do market timing almost inevitably lose money. People who just hang in there and recognize that a bump is coming and ride through the bump generally do quite well. And I think it's important, though, that we know it's coming. I say know it's coming. I say I can't tell you for certain anything about the future. What I can say is market corrections happen, and it's very rare for the stock market to double in value, and it has effectively doubled in value since the bottom in March of 2020. It's very rare for the stock market to double in value without a correction. And a correction is a drop of 10% in the stock market.
And we got to throw in a Yogi Berra quote here. It's really, really difficult to forecast, especially when it's about the future. Yeah. Go right ahead now.
And so what I'm saying is buckle your seatbelts. I would not be surprised to see a bump in the road. Now, let me talk a little bit about COVID again one more time. I track the annualized growth rate of COVID reported by Johns Hopkins every week and have been since this thing started. Back in July, the annualized growth rate of infections reported was 0.49%, which means we got this thing whipped. And we kind of felt like we did. The growth rate right now is 4.12% per year, which doesn't sound like a lot, but it is.
Is it per year or per week?
The annualized, we have is a 0.34% growth rate in infections per week. I multiplied that times 12, 4.12%.
Per week, yeah.
So what we're getting is we're getting a growth rate that is 8 times as high as it was in July. We're getting a death rate that's up to 848. Last week, our average deaths per day in the United States was 848. It was down in the 200 range back in July.
Now, this is the anniversary of 9/11. To say we had just over 3,000 people die on that day in three different places.
And 848 people per day right now and last week have died from COVID.
So in the last week, COVID deaths amount to a lot more than died on 9/11. It's hard to put that in perspective because anytime you get numbers above 5, people tend to lose the personal aspect and it just becomes a group. And as long as it's not a one-time event like 9/11, it's a different kind of trauma. 9/11 happened like we got punched, where this is like strangulation. It's harder to point out one specific moment that is a bad moment. They're all bad, and so we kind of get used to it. It's the frog in the water thing. That doesn't mean we shouldn't alter our behavior to try to stay healthy. We altered our behavior in extreme ways to avoid terrorism and aircrafts.
You know, I've stopped seeing this in the newspapers and so on, but we're up to 655,000 deaths from COVID now in the United States.
Yeah.
Now, why is this important? Because it affects the economy. It's slowing things down. It's not slowing things down in the sense that we're going backwards, but slowing the growth rate down. And we're probably going to see that going forward. And it's one of those things to be prepared for. And we do need to play commercials.
Yes. We have great help at the studio this week, as every week. And thank you very much for the efforts that you're putting in over there. We're going to play some commercials. If you would like to join us in the conversation after we come back, we've got email addresses waiting. Jeff@tpwc.com and Jake@tpwc.com. That's Tango Papa Whiskey Charlie or The Personal Wealth Coach. And we'll be back on the other side of these extremely important announcements. And we're back with more of The Personal Wealth Coach. We got lots to talk about. One of the things that I wanted to bring up is, and I mentioned this last week and the week before, expect horror stories from Washington, D.C. about what's in the new bill, whatever it is. Just don't believe the horror stories until it's in writing.
Whatever new bill.
Any new bill. It's worse now right now because there's a really large new bill. And the fact that it's really large is one of the reasons why it's scary. Because we got to figure out some way to pay for it. It is the new budget. $3.5 trillion. Newt Gingrich doesn't have a whole lot that's still around that he put together. But one of the things that he did was the Balanced Budget Act. And that requires, if you're going to increase spending, to find some way to pay for it.
What?
Oh, I know, it's weird. How are you going to figure out how to pay for it? What do you mean we have to figure out how to pay for it? Yeah. So, whether or not you like Newt Gingrich is irrelevant. I think this is a pretty good thing to have achieved. Now we look at today. $3.5 trillion is more money than we receive in taxes. Oh. Yes, another shocker. This is why we borrow money every year. Our budget is growing faster than our tax revenue, especially during the pandemic. Next year's tax revenue might be great, but there's still a lot of handouts happening to keep us going through the pandemic. We'll see. Got good growth in the economy. We could see more revenue in the future. But for right now, we're trying to find ways in the governmental level of how do we pay for stuff? Well, you don't want to raise taxes. That's, for some reason, people don't like to vote for people that raise their taxes. Even if you say, we got to pay for all these handouts, you'd rather have the handout than be the one doing the handout. That's human nature. Okay, so the Congressional Budget Office has been asked to give estimates on a whole series of different proposed concepts. This is why you should expect horror stories. Because they throw every question imaginable at the CBO. They say,
I like that word, imaginal.
What? Imaginal?
We'll use that in the future.
If you can imagine it as a method of raising money for the government, they're going to say to the CBO, what do you think this would cause in revenue. If we caused everybody's left pinky fingers tax rate to be fill in the blank, what would this do to our revenue? So the other side of the aisle, no matter who they are, it doesn't matter Republican or Democrat, as soon as that happens, that's something that they are aware of. The CBO has been asked by Congress for an estimate. And so they can start trumpeting about it. There is a piece of news that's come out from the CBO that's interesting, though. And that is a proposed increase in the IRS's budget, the Internal Revenue System.
That's Jeff clapping.
Service. Yes, that's Jeff clapping. We have had a moratorium on hiring, a hiring freeze at the IRS for over a decade. Their budget has been lowered for two decades. I had some extremely conservative clients in the office the other day complaining about how they can never get anybody on at the IRS on the phone, how they hate the IRS, but they need to get their act together. Well, this was a conservative movement to lower the power of the IRS. The IRS was slowing down the economy. It was overly funded. It was attacking companies and individuals trying to get taxes that really weren't due. It was over the top. So we had the other end of the pendulum where we lowered the budget and lowered the budget. And what we've found is that the economy is not being slowed by this. That's pretty cool. The IRS is not actively slowing the economy. Taxes are being paid. But we're missing taxes. So by raising the budget of the IRS by $80 billion over a 10-year period, they expect to receive $200 billion returned and money that taxes aren't being paid, isn't being paid on. So, and that's from the CBO. And they're a bunch of apoliticals. Some of them are political, but the vast majority of them are not. And those that are political, there's an even number on each side. So the Congressional Budget Office is really just putting the numbers together to say in their models, what kind of revenue can we expect here? It's all based on estimates, so they get a lot of flack for their predictions. But how about anybody out there listening right now, can you estimate how many numbers of dollars are not being paid in taxes this year? I bet not. Not accurately. The reality is that we have a pretty good idea on this number because audits still occur. And audits still bring in revenue to the government. A lot of revenue. Not as much as normal payments, but a very large amount of revenue comes in because an audit occurs. The IRS shows up and says, prove to us or in some way show us evidence that you don't owe taxes on this thing right here that we found in your papers. And you say, well, I can't. Or the CPA says, well, we just thought we didn't really want to do that thing. And so the IRS says, okay, you owe us some money and some penalties for that. Go ahead. Nobody likes that, by the way. That's not something we advocate for. It's not something I would ever want to be in that position. But if we don't have good tax enforcement, we don't have good tax revenue. So it's one of those things. It's like having to pay for your water bill. At some point, you have to pay for the water bill or the water gets cut off. Taxes have to get paid or you don't need to be driving on the roads because those roads are paid for with taxes. So keeping that in mind, adding some budget to the IRS will add revenue to the government. And the CBO just came out and said that. It's more than a double on the dollar return over a 10-year period. And that's significant. That's a really big deal. I realize it's not a big enough deal to make major headlines in most places. But it means that the pendulum has fully swung the other direction from what it was 15 years ago when the IRS showed up. You're going to write a check no matter if you owed them or not because you owed them. And now we're at the point where you're not going to write the IRS whether you owe them or not. So we need to see the pendulum. I would really love to see it just kind of rest in the middle, but that's not how pendulums usually work. Somebody keeps coming and moving them. Go ahead.
Got several interesting points I wanted to make that are totally on another subject. Intel is investing $95 billion in European chip making factories.
Awesome.
Your chip making factories are springing up across the United States. We have a shortage of computer chips because we have become a computer chip intensive society. We used to be an oil intensive society. We are gradually becoming less oil intensive and far more silicon dependent.
And they're interrelated, just as a side note, because as we move away from oil, other technologies require computer chips. What's really strange is even technologies around oil require computer chips now.
So we've got this shortage is causing temporary inflation. It's causing a slowdown in the economy. And a lot of it has to do with computer chips and ceramics, which are different issues, by the way, even though computer chips are ceramics themselves. Plants are going in quickly. As the price goes up, it becomes far more profitable to make those computer chips and to make those factories and to staff those factories domestically. And so this is getting fixed. And I think that's an important thing to be aware of.
I'm just going to put in a comparison, historical comparison. Mark it in your calendars. Put a little tack in there. If you ever go back to your calendars and look for tax, that's why I use tax. So you'll never look this up again. But mark it anyway. China is Saudi Arabia in 2008.
I don't understand.
Saudi Arabia went in 2007 and 2008 with the Great Recession, went from being the powerhouse of the oil world to being an also-ran. I mean, they still make a lot of oil. They still pull that stuff out of the ground, but fracking took off during the Great Recession. Computer chip manufacturing in the United States is about to take off in the pandemic in the same sense, and China's going to lose the monopoly.
One other thing I want to point out, and we're about out of time here, is that there's a consensus of economists. Now, they're not always right on this, but I happen to agree with them in this case, that interest rates are going to rise in 2022, which means bond markets are going to fall. And I think that's going to happen. So another thing to be prepared for. And we're out of time. It's been wonderful having you listen to us, presuming anyone is listening out there. You are listening to the Personal Wealth Coach. If you'd like to contact us off the air, we have live staff during the week, voicemail during the weekend, locally at 254-947-1111.
Or you can reach that same line toll-free, 1-800-914-7526. That's 800-914-PLAN. You can go to our webpage, thepersonalwealthcoach.com or tpwc.com, where you will find our scary faces and the beautiful staff that we work with. You will find newsletters going back lots of years. You will find recordings of our radio program. You can also go to your favorite podcast provider and look for TPWC. You'll find us. Until next week, this has been the Personal Wealth Coach, and thank you all very much for listening.